Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
This week on Lunchbox Envy, they come in over 10,000 varieties.
Italians love them, but 16% of them are allergic.
And the French used to believe they were an aphrodisiac and called them love apples.
It's tomato time.
Ooh la la.
Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Rosie, I'm a chef and food writer, and I'm here with my two QI elves. Hi, Jack.
Hello.
Hi, Manu.
Well, hello.
This week, we're all about tomatoes. So, in the spirit of that, we are starting, all of us, with a Bloody Mary. Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Bottoms up.
I don't drink them much, I must say. I have had a kimchi Bloody Mary. I think that was the first one I ever had.
Mm. Oh.
Funky.
I think because they're a bit like drinking a soup. Mm. I like them because they're like a pre-starter to whatever I'm eating.
Mm.
But that makes me drunk. Even better.
See, this is the thing. I've only ever had them as a hangover cure,
really?
Given by other people with alcohol in them. And I can't stand them. I don't like soup very much because I like food that you can chew. I'm like, what's the point? And then having like more acidic alcohol in soup the next day is not the one.
Yeah, that's true, actually. I wonder how this is going to go in my gut.
I was going to say, Jack, you've made me an alcohol-free one and I think it's delicious.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It is very good, Jack, I must say. For me, a Bloody Mary, they shouldn't just be relegated to brunch or, you know, as a hair of the dog method. They are great in the evenings. It's originally just vodka and tomato juice. Those were the earliest versions, a 50-50 mix.
A 50-50 mix?
Yeah.
That's so strong.
Savage.
I mean, it's either very strong or very little tomato. That's crazy.
Mm, yeah. Also, you have to wonder how good the tomato juice was back then. Anyway, no one's really sure where the name for Bloody Mary comes from. It might refer to Queen Mary the First. She was known as Bloody Mary because of her brutal persecution of the Protestants.
Cheers.
Oh my God, no. I want it to be about menstruation somehow.
Yeah, I was going to make a period joke, yeah. And I didn't think it was my place.
It definitely is not, by the way.
Well, I like it.
Okay, cool. So let's crack on. Tomatoes. What is a tomato and where do they come from?
Good question.
Great question. It was brought over to Europe by the Spanish colonists from the Andes in around the early 1500s as a part of something that's called the Columbian Exchange, which is a bit of a euphemistic term for a pretty strong, violent period of pilfering the Americas and bringing a lot of goods back to Europe.
And things that went the other way were like horses and unfortunately, smallpox.
Oh, yeah. God.
So if we're talking like scientifically, how do we like define it? Is it...
Where
am I going with this, Jack?
Is it a fruit or a vegetable? So botanically speaking, it is a fruit, of course. So in that it's a seed-bearing plant part, which is why it has seeds. But botanically, there's kind of no such thing as a vegetable. Well, in the same way that there is no such thing as a fish, because... the things that we refer to as vegetables are many and wildly varied, and there's no single consistent thread amongst them. In fact, they're very genetically different, a lot of them.
God, I love working on this show. I've learned so much. One thing I think it's useful to clear up is that tomatoes are not always red. They actually come in a variety of different colours.
Oh my God.
Purple, yellow, white, green, orange, even blue.
What?
Debunking further the theory that there are no blue foods.
Oh, yes, of course.
Still, I can't believe there are white tomatoes. That one, I don't trust.
Yes, the white tomatoes are weird. But I've seen them. You can buy them in like Waitrose in the Natura.
Oh my God.
Heirloom tomato packs.
Nice. I need to get out more.
In the summer, of course, because that's when the tomatoes are at their, in theory, best.
Oh,
something we'll talk about later.
You can make lots of Mediterranean flags then with the tomato. If you had green, white, and red, that's Italian.
Well, that's the red, yellow, story red behind Spain. Margherita, yeah. The pizza, is that it's a representation of the flag, the Italian flag. So the red is the tomato, the white is the mozzarella, and the green is the basil, in support of the queen at the time. Queen Margaret, right? Queen Margarita. Queen Margarita.
Another thing I love about the loads of different types of tomatoes is people have given them the most bonkers names. So one of the really early varieties of wild tomato, which is also really tiny, is called the pimp tomato.
Did that mean something else though back in the day?
Oh, I'm not sure.
Like a pimpernel. The Scarlet Pimpernel. Maybe he was a
tomato. It's a pimple, like a pimple.
Yeah,
like a pimple on, like it looks like a pimple.
So yeah, there's a YouTuber, his channel is called Weird Explorer. If you haven't seen him, do check it. His whole thing is just tasting fruit. Every video, he's tasting an unusual fruit, and in it, he tastes the pimp tomato. He also tastes the blue Java banana that we spoke about on the bananas episode. That's how I found out about
it. The other blue food.
So other weird tomato variety names include Tough Mother, which I like. Big Girl.
Okay.
Outdoor Girl.
Okay.
I'm assuming they're quite resilient breeds.
I'm enjoying the sort of, apart from pimp, the sort of femininity assigned to tomatoes. That feels right. They are, to me, overtly feminine.
Yeah.
They're very, you know, they're kind of like that quintessential fruit, you know, filled with seeds, very sort of abundant, plump, voluptuous. That's giving women. I'm sorry. Wow. It's International Women's Day, everyone. We're recording. So I'm feeling fired up.
There's also Better Boy, which I quite like.
Oh, okay.
Gender parity.
Not Good Boy. Just slightly. Slightly better. So whilst we're talking about names quickly, I love this. So the word tomato we've gotten from the Aztec word, xitumatl, which means plump thing with a navel. There you go. Sexy, plump.
Again, it's
tomato.
Very women.
With
it's giving women.
Well, she tomato.
Yeah, literally. Right, so shall we dive into our first lunchbox? And that is from you, my darling Jack.
Wonderful, yeah. So I've brought a tin of chopped tomatoes.
Wow, what a boring lunchbox, Jack. Christ.
Well, it
didn't have much time to prepare, did you?
You're basic.
hang on. Let me defend myself. It is boring today, but that's only because tins are mass-produced and cheap. And once upon a time, it was a brand new cutting-edge technology that was shaping the world. And there are two reasons why. Firstly, tins are amazing, and I'm going to talk about that later. But secondly, mass-producing tomatoes is a really interesting story behind it. But anyway, this is quite important part of history is the invention of canning, and specific to tomatoes, they were only canned en masse in the 1950s, and all thanks to an American botanist called Charles Rick. Basically, tomatoes at the time, they had many varieties, but the most popular one ticked all the boxes for like fast growing, tasty, didn't spoil too bad. But the one downside was when you would pluck them, the green bit would stay on, which is so inconvenient when you're trying to mechanize the process and you need a human dexterous hand to remove the green bit. So what we needed was a type of tomato that comes clean off the vine when you pull it and doesn't leave the stalk remaining like an apple. So what he did was he went and he found varieties around the world, one of which grew on the Galapagos Islands. And this one had the perfect detachability, but it was very hard to grow en masse. And so he was trying to find a way to help these seeds to germinate. And he realized that when they passed through the digestive tract of a giant tortoise, they grew much easier. And it's partly because the stomach removes some of the outer layers. Anyway, once he cracked this, he fed tomatoes to many Galapagos tortoises. And then he grew the varieties from their stool. And then once he had enough, he could crossbreed them with the popular tomatoes. All the American tomatoes suddenly were very detachable because they had this trait that had come from the Galapagos tomato. And then they could be plucked automatically. And so then you could mass produce them and then you could tin them.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
From tortoise poo
to tin tomato
to your bloody bolognese dinner that you're having tonight, ladies and gentlemen.
But the interest that, I mean, canning's an amazing thing. Back in the 1820s, when tinning was just getting going, it was a very expensive item to have. You'd have, you know, one tin that you'd get out at your fancy meal when you were serving guests, and you'd open it up and you'd be a whole year old and everyone would marvel at the freshness of it. But they started getting used in exploration to the Arctic to find the Northwest Passage in 1824. Spoiler alert, there is no Northwest Passage. So all of these expeditions failed, but they had some tins with them, one of which was discovered 12 years after the ship went down. It was opened in 1939 and eaten because all of the goods were delicious and completely fresh.
Archaeologists love eating old shit. So why do they do this? It's like when they found that really old honey and the first in the...
from like the Egyptian era.
Oh, so I remember reading about these archaeologists in the 1950s, I think, in Greenland, and they found what they thought was like old frozen bison meat, which would have been thousands of years old. And they were like, you know, we're going to do... eat that giant, as well. Yeah. And then they found out it was a dog.
Oh my God.
Why do scientists eat this stuff?
It's like, so they understand food hygiene better than most people.
That's true.
Surely. So to then eat a 1,000-year-old frozen and defrosted mystery meat is honestly psychotic to me.
Well, we eat turkey Twizzlers. We don't know what's in them.
But they're not thousands of years old, no, famously. Okay, wow. I mean, I can't believe that one of the world's most favorite ingredients was cultivated through tortoise poo.
And it's not just tortoise poo either. We've actually discovered the trope is that you find them in railway tracks back when you used to spit the sewage onto the railway. They don't do it anymore, by the way, in this country at least. So when you eat tomatoes, the seeds are really good at surviving the journey through your gut and the digestive tract. And in fact, it helps them to thrive. They've evolved to be germinated this way. And there's an interesting story. In 1963, an eruption under the sea near Iceland created the newest island in the world off the coast of Iceland. And it's known as Surtsey. It's still there. So it was a really interesting opportunity for scientists because there was this fresh new land. It was created by a volcano under the sea. And it's a great opportunity to see how a landscape and a biome comes out of nowhere. It's virgin rock. It's just like there's nothing else there. Anyway, one scientist visited in 1967 and was puzzled to see there was one tomato plant that was growing out of what looked like the plain rock. And when he explored, it had been a little cairn of rocks built, and he opened it up and he worked out that it was a previous scientist who'd done a dump, eaten some tomatoes, and the seed had survived and grown, and it was the first life form on Surtsey.
Wow. Bloody hell. They're just pooey as hell.
And in fact, I was looking on Reddit and there was a Redditor who'd said that like they'd applied for a job at a sewage treatment plant. And they'd revealed that they had an annual contract to remove tomato plants from all the sewage pipes of their local town. Tomato plants just love shit.
From the ashes.
Yeah.
I love tomatoes because the more I was reading about this, the more I found out that they're quite communicative plants.
Oh, interesting.
Wow. So you know how there's a whole story about trees and mushrooms having networks of fungi where they can like swap stories
about... the wood wide web.
Yes.
That's
I think that is what they've coined it as.
I know.
It's a tabloid term for it, but yeah.
I love humans sometimes for things like that.
Tomatoes communicate with each other similarly through fungal networks. So they can chat about where all of the water sources are. They can recognize their fellow tomato plants and make sure they aren't encroaching on each other's territory and like stealing resources.
They can sort of rate films in a sort of website, maybe called Rotten Tomatoes.
I wonder if it's time for lunchbox number two. What do you think?
Oh, let's go for it.
Yes, please.
It's from me, actually. As usual, I brought something that doesn't fit in my lunchbox, so bear with.
Yeah, but these are always the best ones.
Wow. Get all my stuff out. We've got a bit of a DIY situation here.
Oh, God.
We are going to be making a dish that is so famous now and really seems to have become more famous in the last 3 to 4 years.
Okay.
I'm not really sure why, but I'm sure you've heard of it. I'm sure you've eaten it. It's the Spanish dish, pan con tomate.
Oh, I love this stuff.
I should say off the top, it's actually Catalonian.
Oh, so, controversial.
To be clear, Catalonia is a state within Spain, famously keen for its own independence. It's where Barcelona is. And in Catalan, the name for pan con tomate is pan amb tomaquet. But we will call it pan con tomate today because we know that as what we see on the menus for 12, 13 quid sometimes.
Which literally translates as?
Which literally translates as bread with tomato.
Amazing.
So before we eat, before we start, this started in Catalonia, as I said, in the countryside. Back then, one of the ways that peasants would revive stale bread is they would rub it with olive oil. Then tomatoes came along. And in the 19th century, people started doing the same thing with tomatoes. They started to revive their stale bread. They'd rub the tomatoes on it.
Okay.
It's a pretty important symbol of Catalonian cultural identity, this dish. It's really, really significant.
I thought you were going to say rubbing tomatoes on things.
Oh, right. Sorry. Just rubbing everything with tomatoes. What? Well, there is the famous tomato festival, Tomatina.
Oh, is that?
Which is in Valencia, right?
I think so.
Which is where they throw tomatoes at each other. Different thing. Anyway. The reason why I want to talk about it is because what we eat in the UK when people present you this dish is actually really different to what the real thing is.
Okay.
How do I know this? Because I bloody went there.
Oh.
I went to Catalonia.
For this show.
No. A few years ago, one of my various jobs that I've had over the years was working on sort of luxury culinary holidays. And we did a special trip out to Catalonia to a town called Sitges, which is about half an hour away from Barcelona. Very beautiful. We went with a famous Spanish chef and he showed us the perfect pan tumaca, the perfect pan con tomate. Importantly, we have been missing a key ingredient here in the UK, and that is a special tomato produced in Spain, which is solely for the purpose of pan con tomate.
Wow.
And it's called tomates de colgar, which means hanging tomatoes.
Nice.
So these tomatoes, they are their own little species, but importantly, it's the storage of them that is what makes them unique. So once they've been picked, they're still not quite ripe. They are sewn into pieces of string and hung in dark, well-ventilated spaces.
Wow.
This is a preventative measure because tomatoes, in order to ripen, they produce a chemical, a plant hormone called ethylene.
Mm.
And it's what makes them ripen faster. And it's also what makes them ripen other things. If you ever heard that sort of old wives tale, like put your fruit with your tomatoes or your bananas, it's because they produce lots of ethylene, mm-hmm. which makes them ripen faster.
So it's true. It's, I mean, old wives
tale. It is actually
often
true. It's really true. So one thing I wanted to talk about today was why British tomatoes often taste really shit.
Yes, I found this.
It's because commercially, in mass production, very often tomatoes are picked green and artificially ripened with added in ethylene. They add in more ethylene than is actually present, which means that they ripen really fast, which means that they miss out on a lot of the key flavor production,
of course,
juiciness,
yeah.
texture. So the literal opposite is the case with tomates de colgar. They hang for a long time. They ripen really slowly because they're well ventilated. They're not round other things. And this creates like this most unbelievably flavorsome, juicy tomato.
What?
Amazing. I actually don't have any today, obviously.
It was yanked away from us. That
I know.
Was such a
sorry. But they're quite hard to come by. And I wasn't recently in Catalonia, sadly. Oh. Hint to my husband. So basically, tomatoes de colgar, what I've got today are just some pretty nice, fine tomatoes. One thing I think is also important to note about the dish specifically is that when we eat this in the UK, you will most often see literally like a pile of grated tomato on top of bread. That is not actually how it's supposed to be. Because of the type of tomatoes that we have available, sometimes grating is actually going to get you a better flavor result because we just don't have these beautiful tomates de colgar. But we're going to do it the right way, the original way today, which is we're literally going to rub them on our bread.
And sorry, can I just, because I have heard of this dish, I didn't know all the details. It's fascinating that they've created their own variety for it. But do you ever add anchovies or is that sacrilege?
No. I mean, you definitely would add anchovies, but culturally, this dish is sort of historically for poor people, for and peasants. Mm. And so adding luxury things like jamón and anchovies isn't the sort of point of it. The point was to revive your bread with the tomatoes.
Yeah. Nice.
And it had this little bit of delicious, rich so sweet and juicy tomato on top. I mean, heaven.
Is this partly why things taste nicer on holiday? I mean, obviously some of it is that you're relaxed and you're, you know, treating yourself, you're eating out quite a lot more than you would at home. But also just the kind of, I always think like the French, when I'm on holiday in France, the French don't export their good peaches because the peaches in France are so nice.
Yeah. Well, I think there is certainly, you know, climate has a lot to do with it.
Mm.
Being able to have sun-ripened fruit and veg is massively beneficial. And interestingly, something I found out in my research is that eating tomatoes grown in the UK is actually worse environmentally than eating ones grown from Spain.
Oh, really? But out of season?
Because buying Spanish tomatoes out of season is less damaging to the environment than buying British tomatoes grown in heated greenhouses. That sun, that natural energy source, is more environmentally sound.
It overcomes the shipping
than the other
costs,
version. Yeah. In a BLT, for example, the tomato may have a higher carbon footprint than the bacon. BLT, for anyone who doesn't know, sadly for you, is a bacon, lettuce and tomato sandwich. Okay, shall we have a little taste?
Let's go for it.
So what I'm going to do is I'm literally going to rub it.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Squeeze it
I'm
and rub it.
I'm rubbing it here.
Don't make it obvious like that.
As the Spanish do.
As the Spanish
do.
Oh
my God.
I'm going to season mine with a bit of salt.
I'm making such a mess of this also.
That's perfect. That's literally all you need.
Yeah.
Oh, what?
Yeah, it's not supposed to be as loaded as it is in a restaurant. If you're in the UK and your tomato bread comes out like that, you'd be like, sorry, mate, where's the rest of it? Like, whereas we know now that this is actually how it's supposed to be.
Mm. Also, now we've spoken about the seed poop phenomenon. I can't unsee it. The seeds that are all over this bread, I'm like, that is going straight through me.
We could be growing several tomato things. Right, enjoy.
Thank you, Rosie. Oh, it's so simple, but so good.
Mm.
It's one of those dishes for which it's really important because there aren't many ingredients, so you need good quality ones. And I imagine when you're in Catalonia, it's even better.
Yeah, exactly. And also, but like, I just think this is a breakfast or like a working from home lunch, maybe with, you know, some other things on the side, like ham and anchovies, as you said, or a salad or some boiled eggs. Like, that's just unbeatable, that. That's just so good. Mm. Okay, so I have a bugbear about this. I never buy commercially produced, so mass produced sandwiches, let's say from, you know, Boots or Tesco, whatever, that contain tomato in, because the factories that make these sandwiches, they put something on the tomatoes to make them not be soggy sandwiches.
Yeah.
So what I read was that they put modified starches or hydrocolloids, so for example, xanthan gum, that firm up the tomatoes to an extent that they don't leak in the sandwich.
Okay. Yeah.
But what that does is it changes the texture completely, makes them very jelly-like, very sort of, but also at the same time, sandy.
Mm.
And the flavor's crap. It's just not pleasant to eat, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
So I literally won't buy them. I will only eat tomato sandwiches that have been made by my own hands.
I'm more of a, if I'm getting a supermarket sandwich, it's either in a massive rush or I'm hungover and it's like the only thing that I want is just a bad sandwich, which I call a bamwich. That's when you know I'm not feeling well, is I have a bamwich. Also, part of my research for this, I heard the term tomato summer mentioned. And I had
Tomato girl summer?
Yeah, I had no idea what this was. And I'm still not entirely sure what it is, apart from people dressing a bit Italian.
Maybe it's just getting plump and showing your navel.
Could be that. Really up for that as well, just to say. Mm. Go on, girls.
Hashtag free the navel.
Free the navel.
Nice. So, big question, Rosie, that I think you'll be able to answer.
Mm-hmm.
To fridge or not to fridge?
Ooh.
That is the question. Do you put your tomatoes in the fridge?
No, you should not put your tomatoes in the fridge.
What?
For lots of different reasons. One, have some bloody pride. Buy good tomatoes. Anywho, chilling is a major stress for tropical plants. Imagine those poor tomatoes screaming their heads off as you put them in the fridge. They say, not the smeg.
That's a common refrain in Rosie's household. Well, not the smeg.
Stop it.
The process of chilling something down reduces the activity of the genes that they have.
Okay.
And these genes that are the things that produce enzymes or hormones like ethylene responsible for the chemicals that make tomatoes taste sweeter in the ripening process. So you're essentially freezing them in the process of ripening. So no, you should not be putting them in the fridge. If you want them to taste good, for me, it's a firm no.
But if you want tomatoes, I mean, they do keep longer, right? Yeah. So if you desperately need tomatoes in a week and you can't go shopping in the meantime, put them in the fridge.
Well, you know, in the seasons that we have in the UK, I don't think it's that important unless it's really high summer and very, very hot. Mm. One of the lessons out of this, I knew it was always going to come down to this with the tomato episode, is that like you have to pay attention to what you're buying if you want to get a good product.
But anyway. Also, food is expensive.
So. Food is expensive. It's getting more expensive by the day. Mm-hmm. So we do acknowledge that like there is a privilege to being able to shop that way for sure. Mm-hmm.
Whilst we're talking about this, preserving food, I was listening to a really interesting episode of the podcast Radiolab, where they talk about food preservation, particularly fresh fruit and veg.
Yeah.
And the way they talk about it, I'd never considered it. Your food, when you buy fresh produce, your food is literally alive. Like those fruits and veg are alive.
Yeah.
And what you're trying to do is slow down their death.
Yeah.
Which
it's so
is
true.
Mad.
Wild.
One of the really lovely things is lettuces. So like, you know, when you get those bags of like mixed salad, the way that they're constructed is to let them breathe in a really specific way. So it controls the flow of like oxygen and carbon dioxide in and out of the bag, which I had never thought of before. So like all of your tiny vegetables are breathing like in the fridge and dying. But yeah, it was
and then you just shove a load of Dijonais on them and say goodbye.
But that is mad. And apparently when scientists are studying how to keep these fruits and veg alive, they'll like put little monitors on them and hook them up to machines.
Oh,
it's like a little vegetable hospital.
Oh my God, my ovaries just exploded.
This crap was not tested on vegetables.
Oh God.
Time now for our final lunchbox from the sweetest cherry in the room, Miss Manu.
Thank you, Rosie. I have
cherry tomatoes.
Oh, beautiful.
Nice. Thank you. Aren't they very plump, very sexy? But these ones I've bought specifically to look at. There will be no eating today. We're just going to look at them.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So they're bred for their looks, were they?
When tomatoes were first brought over to the UK, we were quite suspicious of them and decided to use them as decorations rather than for eating.
That is so us.
I know. We mentioned a bit about how the Spanish first brought them over in the early 1500s, but because they are a member of the nightshade family, people thought that they were poisonous. So they were sometimes called wolf peaches or poison apples. And to be fair, the stems and the leaves do contain poisonous alkaloids, like other nightshades. So potatoes, aubergines, they all have these poisonous chemicals in them. And that's to help protect the plants from parasitic fungi. So if you were to eat a ton of tomato leaves, it would have to be about 500 grams worth of them. You would get sick.
Okay, that's a relief.
Yes.
I definitely have a recipe that I've posted a lot, which is a tomato risotto, and you make a stock for the risotto with the vines.
Oh.
But not that many, not 500 grams
that's
worth.
That's fine. I think a bit because the smell is amazing.
Yeah.
But it is also like it can make you sick.
I looked into this actually, the lethal dose of solanine, which is the alkaloid in tomato, one of the many alkaloids in tomatoes. It's slightly toxic. It's 5 milligrams per kilo of body weight. And interestingly, the amount of solanine in a tomato is 5 milligrams per kilo. So basically, you have to eat your body weight's worth of tomato stalks.
Whoa.
Oh, God.
Pretty crazy.
Okay, well, that's lucky.
Yeah, I was going to say, your recipe's fine.
I think my recipe's fine.
So yeah, there's a few stories around the legend of the poison tomato in Europe. And one of them is to do with plates. So when they first came over to Europe, obviously quite expensive and hard to grow, especially in the UK, and only rich people could afford them. And rich people tended to eat off pewter plates, which is a mixture of tin and lead. And tomatoes are really acidic. So tomato juice will leach lead from the plates And there was an idea that rich people were getting lead poisoning from eating tomatoes off these plates. But what's interesting is there's actually very little evidence to support this story, because the quantities of tomatoes they would have had to eat were so big, because like the leaching from the plates would have been minimal. So it's just a story. And over time, people became less and less terrified of tomatoes because, say in Spain, people absolutely loved them because they'd been eating them there for a really long time. And we were looking at the Spanish going like, but they're fine. Yeah, why are we? Anyway.
That's a good point. Why are we looking at the Spanish and thinking like, why are they not all dead?
That's exactly what happened. The same with looking at the Italians as well. We're like, oh, they're surviving. So we started eating them more. What was really interesting is there was one kind of tomato that was ornamental for a really long time despite this, and that was the tiny cherry-sized tomato. They weren't like a popular ingredient until the 1970s. And it wasn't until Marks and Spencer's and some scientists from Israel decided to collaborate and create a cherry tomato that was like a much easier to grow, sweeter, and transported well, that cherry tomatoes kind of exploded across the Western culinary scene, which is why you kind of see them popping around dishes all over the 80s and 90s. Like they're really popular, like 90s food.
Sun-dried tomatoes as well.
Ooh.
Hella vintage. When I see a sun-dried tomato on the menu, I think, wow, it's really nice to be back in 1995.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they are good though. Obviously, the Israeli scientists didn't invent the cherry tomato. They just helped develop a new one. But the Israeli government gave this to its citizens as a conversation starter abroad to talk about, like, we invented the cherry tomato, if they got stuck for things to talk about and wanted to big up their home country.
An icebreaker. Oh.
What would we give the UK?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Scotch eggs.
Marmite, have you had that? Pretty good.
Yeah.
Scotch eggs, yeah. Fry ups.
So they are, now I'm looking at them properly. I mean, they look delicious. I want to eat it.
They look like
but
jewels.
I can understand why you'd use these as an ornamental plant. Like, they're so colourful. They are, they're just like, I want to pop them with my eyes.
They're really evocative and beautiful and shapely, just like women. And they are a great decoration. When you say ornamental.
Just like women.
Just like women. When you say ornamental, it makes me think of that, what we were talking about earlier. Like, don't put your tomatoes in the fridge. They're too beautiful for that. They deserve to be out in the middle of your, you know, prep space and your work, your table, whatever, just doing their thing, just living their lives, having their great catwalk in the kitchen, right? They're sexy. Let them out. Let them free. Free the tomato. Free the navel. That's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy. You can follow our socials for foodie facts and for podcast updates. We are on X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
Yeah, that's right. And you can also email us and send us your facts, recipes, questions, abuse. And the address is lunchbox@qi.com.
Rosie, any bonus tomato recipes for us?
Yes, I do, actually. In my Substack newsletter, The Dinner Party, I wrote a recipe called Tomato Cured Fish, where I basically used tomato juice to make a sort of ceviche, and it worked really, really well, and it was so summery and delicious.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
Okay, we will leave you with some wise words to live by. Life is like a tomato. You need to be firm but not hard, soft but not mushy, and never afraid to get a little saucy. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Jack Chambers, Manu Orio, and me, Rosie McKean. It was mixed by Li Ying Lee, and it was produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.